Hello, and welcome to the Victorian Gas Lamp, the podcast shining a warm light on the 19th century, and most notably, throughout the reign of Her Majesty, Queen Victoria. Episode 49, The Resurrection Men, Part 2. As we left off our story last episode, Part 1, we had the Williams, Burke and Hare, heading off to meet Robert Knox, a local professor that was apparently in need of a body. And as I said, infamous history was about to be made. Robert Knox was actually a really smart man. However, this podcast isn't about him, but suffice to say he graduated from the University of Edinburgh in 1814, worked in St. Bartholomew's Hospital in London, joined the army, aided the wounded at the Battle of Waterloo, travelled to Africa, and by 1822 was back in Edinburgh as a Fellow of the Royal Society. He was also a racist, believing in what is now known as scientific racism. This belief encompassed the idea that you could justify superiority on empirical evidence. The short version of an explanation is that people like him would pick and choose from scientific data that proved their point. So I would judge him intellectually questionable, to say the least, regardless of the positive contributions he made to various scientific theories. But he was also morally questionable, and more than comfortable taking acquisition of a body that had come from, well, questionable sources. So again, let us set another dramatic scene. 'Twas a dark and stormy night as Messrs. Burke and Hare sought to find the professor that would purchase their horrible package. Desperate for money, they found a student at Edinburgh University, upon whom they imposed for directions to a professor that would no doubt pay them handsomely for what they had. Inadvertently directed to Robert Knox, they rapped on his door as thunder dramatically rolls in the background. A flash of lightning illuminates the scene of two men and their terrible package meeting the man that was more than happy to engage in business with the Resurrection Men. Okay, maybe that was slightly too dramatic, but moving on. Because after a little negotiation, Knox was more than happy to pay £7.10 for the body. William Hare got the greater share, a little over £4, which would take care of the rent arrears, and the rest went to Burke. The business deal was sealed with the admission that Knox would be more than happy to deal with them again, should they have another body made available for purchase. As I mentioned in last episode, this occurred in November of 1828. And as the new year of 1829 started, well, the two Williams found another opportunity to make some pretty easy money. There is some question as to the timing exactly of when this occurred, but in early 1829, the general consensus seems to be that one of the lodgers at William Hare's lodging house had the misfortune to get sick. The man was a miller, known only to history as Joseph. He had contracted some sort of flu and was delirious as he endured the fever brought on by his sickness. Hare and his wife Margaret had concerns regarding this state of affairs. After all, having an infectious lodger at the premises could be bad for business. Trying to find a solution, Hare once again turned to his friend and drinking buddy, William Burke. And a plan was hatched. The sick Joseph was plied with whiskey to get him drunk, and once in an inebriated state, Hare used a pillow across the poor man's face. While he was doing this, Burke used his weight on Joseph's chest. Unable to breathe and any attempt to catch more oxygen being constrained by the weight of Burke, Joseph was soon suffocated. This time, the men made no mistake in who they were going to sell the body to. Robert Knox was clearly pleased with the offering, because this time he paid a full £10 for the murdered Joseph. No questions asked. So the two immoral men had done very well for themselves in alleviating the sick Joseph from his flu symptoms. It was not long after this occurred that a travelling match and tinder salesman made William Hare's lodgement house his temporary home. For the record, a tinder salesman means he was selling wood and kindling for fires. As a shock to younger listeners, people didn't have mobile phones or apps. Anyway, the match and tinder salesman had the misfortune to contract jaundice while at the lodging house. Again, Hare had the concern that having someone ill on the premises could be detrimental to his business. And so he turned to his friend, and now apparent business partner, William Burke. Given how the last murder went, why would you try and change a good thing, so to speak? The alcohol, Hare, the pillow, and Burke pressing on the poor man's chest quickly saw the man dead. And the two men made another £10 from Robert Knox, who again was more than happy to take a corpse in such a good state. No questions asked. Around the same time, a woman named Abigail Simpson was also targeted. She was a pensioner from a nearby town who supplemented her meagre income with selling salt. For some unknown reason, she was invited to the lodging house where she too met the same unfortunate end as the unknown match salesman. Knox took her body as well, complimenting the men on the freshness of the corpse. And another £10 was made. For those wondering, £10 in 1828 would be worth around £1,300 today, which is about 3,000 Australian or about $2,500. So, looking at this from a purely economic perspective, the two men were making a great deal of money in the early weeks and months of 1829. Hare's wife Margaret was clearly involved in the new business venture, because it was in early February that she invited an old woman to the lodgement house to have a few drinks. Once she had passed out, she too was suffocated and sold to Knox for another £10. Another opportunity presented itself a few weeks later in April when Burke met two women in the Canongate district of Edinburgh. A hard night's drinking then saw him inviting them out to breakfast. Burke actually took them to his brother's home rather than the lodgement house, and it was here that one of the women, Mary Patterson, passed out drunk. Janet Brown was the other woman who'd been out drinking as well, and she and Burke continued talking while her friend lay passed out in the room. To Janet's shock, a woman burst into the house. This was Helen McDougall, Burke's wife, and she was livid, believing that her husband had been having an affair. Naturally, given the temperament of these people, a loud and violent argument blew up, during the course of which Burke threw a glass at his wife, cutting her above the eye. Janet Brown was shocked at what was happening and managed to tell Helen that she had no idea Burke was married, and she promptly left. Helen also stormed out, but she returned, this time bringing William Hare and his wife Margaret. The two men, being 19th century men, went on to have a discussion amongst themselves and leaving their spouses out of it. Whatever might have been said is unrecorded, however, they then killed poor Mary Patterson. To give you some idea of the ethics being held by Burke's wife, for all her carry-on about him possibly having an affair, she was more than happy to take the dead woman's skirt and petticoats. Stuffing her body into a tea chest, they then took her to their medical benefactor. She was still warm when Knox took possession of her. One of his assistants thought he recognised the corpse and asked where she had been taken from. Burke and Hare said she had drunk herself to death and they had bought the body from some old woman in Canongate. Janet Brown, to her credit, did go back and look for her friend. She was told that Mary had met a travelling salesman and gone to Glasgow. Presumably satisfied with this information, she didn't pursue the matter. Maybe she thought that a travelling salesman and going to Glasgow was a good option compared to the quality of her life in Edinburgh. As an outsider, I do know there is some competition between the two cities as to which is preferable. I think of it as like what we have here in Australia between Melbourne and Sydney. Both think they're the best, and it's a constant source of civic competition as to which is better. We all know it's Melbourne, of course, but Sydney, you keep trying. Moving on. For the record, I see both Edinburgh and Glasgow with the ardent eyes of a tourist who loves Scotland. The two cities have different energies, but are both well worth a visit anytime you're in the United Kingdom. Edinburgh Castle and Holyrood House in Edinburgh are well worth the visit, and I highly recommend taking the tourist bus, visiting the Kelvin Grove Art Gallery, and also the Necropolis and other sites in Glasgow. Thank you for listening to my 5-second tourism review. Mid-1829 saw an older woman, Mrs. Haldane, lodge at Hare's house. Drinking too much, she fell asleep and was then the next sale to Robert Knox. In a bizarre coincidence, her daughter also lodged at the house a short time later, and after drinking with Burke, he then killed her and sold her to make another £8 from Knox. I'll take a quick aside from all this slaughter to point out that alcohol was often made at home during this time. Loosely titled gin, it was strong and sold and imbibed in large quantities. And by large, I mean having a pint was not out of the question. So having people passing out from drinking was not an uncommon effect. May of that year saw the murder of yet another older woman who was then sold. Next was a woman by the name of Effie. She was known to Burke and made her living by scrounging through bins and rubbish piles for scraps to sell. Some of the leather pieces she found were sold to Burke for use in his business as a cobbler. Again, Burke and Hare got her drunk and killed her, quickly selling her on to their benefactor. And the men were growing bolder in their actions, because not long after the last killing, Burke was out walking a local street when he saw a police constable aiding a very drunk woman home. In an apparent act of civility, Burke offered to take her home. The policeman accepted the offer, whereupon Burke took her back to the lodgement house, when he and Hare killed her and then sold the body. A month later saw more violence. In June, an old woman and her grandson, who apparently was dumb, in that he could not speak, were staying at the lodgement house. While there, Burke and Hare murdered the old woman in her room. Again, they used the method where Burke pressed his body on her chest, making it harder to breathe as Hare suffocated her with a pillow. The two killers then went out to where the young boy sat by the warming fire. They picked him up, they took him back to the room where his grandmother had just been killed, and tragically, he too was murdered. With two bodies this time, the usual tea chest that was used to carry corpses was too small, so the men used a barrel. On the journey to Surgeon's Square, the location where Knox lived, the horse pulling the wagon stopped part of the way and refused to go any further. In what I would describe as a cold, calculating manner, Hare paid a porter with a wagon cart to carry their cargo the rest of the trip, for which Knox paid them £16 for the two bodies. And for me, what happens next is an interesting turning point. Serial killers, be they single or a couple, get an emotional satisfaction out of their actions. And by that I mean that they shorten the time between their kills. Crudely put, think of it as an addiction and they need to get that, air quote, hit more often. The men were clearly comfortable with what they were doing, but they were also shortening the time between their kills. Additionally, serial killers tend to unravel mentally. I guess it's like the heinous actions such monsters commit inflicts injuries on their brains. In my opinion, it's why they get caught. They stop thinking properly and they start making errors in judgment. An example of that in this case is that after the murders of the grandmother and the grandson and the horse stalling, pulling the wagon, William Hare was so angry that when getting back to the lodgement house, he shot the horse. this was a man that was purportedly killing people for money that he desperately needed. And a horse was an expensive asset. It's kind of like he burnt his car just because it stalled in the street. His reaction was clearly an overreaction to what was happening and showed how his mental state was disintegrating. In late June, William Burke and his wife Helen went to Falkirk to visit her father. And when they returned to the lodgement house, they found Hare wearing new clothes. Now, Burke knew that his friend was strapped for cash, to the point he had even pawned some of his own clothing. Burke confronted Hare about where he had got the money from. Had he killed someone while Burke had been away? Hare denied doing so, but upon checking with Knox, Burke found out that Hare had in fact delivered a woman's body and received £8. Furious, Burke confronted Hare, and in the ensuing argument, the men actually fought before Burke decided to take his wife and leave to go live in his cousin's house. It was only a couple of streets away, so it was hardly like it was a massive dramatic move, and within a couple of months, the two men were talking again. Hare was visiting Burke at Burke's cousin's house around the end of September when a washerwoman came to the property to do the laundry. Again, following their habit with practiced ease, Burke and Hare got talking to her over drinks, and once she was drunk, they killed her. By that afternoon, her body was sold to Knox for another £8. And it was only a couple of weeks later that Anne McDougall, who was a relative of Burke's wife, made a visit to London from Falkirk. I'm sure that she must have been excited to have come from a small Scottish town and see the huge city that was Edinburgh. Maybe she just wanted to visit a relative and spend some time with her. Maybe she had hoped that coming here she could change her fortune, finding work and financial success. None of that matters now, or then, because within a few days of arriving in Edinburgh, Anne was killed by Burke and Hare and sold for another £10. And I do think this reinforces my idea of how the men were becoming sloppy in their work. Thinking of it by pure logic, it's one thing to kill someone that is simply staying at a lodgement house. The population is largely transient and less likely to be missed. But killing a relative starts to create pathways and connections that can be easily followed, so you'd have to count it as a risky move to say the least. Further to this was the fact that their next victim was an 18-year-old man who was well known on the streets of Edinburgh. James Wilson was a professional beggar and a common sight to the locals. He had a limp caused by a deformed feet and was also mentally disabled in some way. According to author Alana Knight, his common street name was Daft Jamie, which was obviously referencing his intellectual shortcomings. November saw Hare entice Jamie to the lodgement house with the promise of whiskey, while sending his wife to fetch Burke quickly. Jamie didn't really like whiskey much though, and so was much more sober than most of their victims. He actually tried fighting them off before succumbing to their usual murderous tactics. Quickly sold to Knox, it was only the next day that he was on the autopsy table being examined. Because Jamie was kind of a local celebrity, some of the students recognised him, although Knox denied it could be the man they thought it was. Word started getting out that Jamie was missing, so in an attempt to ensure his continued personal safety, Knox cut the head and feet off poor Jamie's body before it was dissected in class to make sure that he was not again recognised. And it was then on Halloween that Burke met Margaret Doherty. She was a middle-aged Irish woman and accepted an invitation to have a few drinks with Burke on the grounds that he had said his mother was a Doherty from the same area of Ireland. Drinking at his cousin's house ensued, and at one point Burke said he had to go buy more whiskey, leaving Margaret in the company of his wife while he was actually going to get Hare and bring him back to the premises. It was not only Burke and his wife Helen that were living at the cousin's home. His cousin also ran the premises as a lodgement house, similar to what Hare was doing with his place. In the poorer areas of Edinburgh, space was at a premium and wages, as those of you who have listened to more than one episode will know, were terrible. but you needed somewhere to sleep, so a great many people would lodge in a room offered by a house owner. For many, this was the entirety of your personal space. You didn't have an apartment or a house, you had a room to put your personal stuff in and basically lived your life outside the room. I think it's for this economic reason that pub culture is so prevalent in the UK. A pub wasn't just a bar where you went to drink, it was an extension of your home. You only had a small living space, so to meet your friends, you'd invite them down to your local pub or meet them there, because they were probably in the same residential state as you. That's one outsider's opinion, by the way, so don't hate me for it. And for the record, I do love a UK pub. They're the best. Being Australian, we drink for a living, but the social environment in a classic UK pub is amazing. Anyway, back to murder. So Burke had left to get hair and left his wife Helen in the company of the heavily drinking Margaret. And while they were drinking, there were also two other lodgers in the lounge room. James and Anne Gray were staying there as well. When Burke and Hare returned, they realised that there was the potential for witnesses and so offered to pay for a night at Hare's lodgement house with the excuse that Margaret was a relative and they were having a family catch-up. That night, after much drinking, the men murdered poor Margaret and hid her body in a pile of straw that was kept in what had been the Grey's bedroom. I'm not actually sure why you would have a pile of straw in your room. I'm speculating, thinking it was what you kept on the floor and trying to keep the room fresh. But the next day, Anne and James Grey returned to collect some of their things from the room they had been staying in. However, Burke wouldn't let them near the bed. Suspicious, when they were later left alone in the house, the couple checked the room and found Margaret's body in the straw. They quickly left the property with the intention of reporting it to the police. On their way, they bumped into Helen. The ensuing conversation resulted in Helen offering them £10 a week to stay quiet. As I've mentioned before, this was a lot of money. And getting it weekly? Well, that was basically a free, high-paying wage. And again, I am going to speculate, but you'd have to agree with me that as Helen clearly knew what was going on and how regularly her husband and his friend murdered people, that the Greys were quickly going to be on the list for killing. But the Greys smartly refused and continued on their way, so props to them for standing on their morals. Now, notified by Helen, Burke and Hare took the body to Knox's surgery where they sold it. The Greys did go to the police, who then went to the lodgement house. In searching it, they found blood-stained clothing hidden under the bed. Questioning Burke and his wife separately, the two gave different times in their stories about when Margaret had left last night. Subsequently taken in for questioning, the police learnt of Robert Knox's involvement and upon attending his offices, they found Margaret's body. Identification by James Grey determined that this had been the woman he had seen at the premises, and Burke and his wife were quickly arrested, as was John Brogan, the cousin of Burke who owned the house. Hare and his wife were also arrested around the same time and initially interviewed. It was during this time that John Brogan was released. The four suspects were kept separated and questioning continued. For the police, this allowed them to find discrepancies in the stories so that they could further divine the actual truth. Two doctors examined Margaret Doherty, and while they thought she had been suffocated, the doctors couldn't be certain of this. However, based on this examination, the two men were charged with Margaret's murder. During the investigation, Robert Knox was interviewed. Knox claimed that he suspected Burke and Hare had been collecting bodies of deceased people from lodging houses before relatives could retrieve them, but he had no proof either way. As far as the police were concerned at this time, there was no legal avenue to charge Knox with anything. But even though the police had charged the two married couples with Margaret's murder, they were uncertain a conviction could be made. At this stage, they thought they knew that at least one of them had committed Margaret's murder, but the question was, who done it? Also, the police thought there had been more murders, given that they knew that Knox had purchased multiple bodies from the two men. But again, here, without actual bodies to supply evidence, the police were in a grey area for convictions. Naturally, it took a hot minute for all this to be splashed all over the newspapers. Any given murder or violent act was always going to make the news, and having a series of murders, well, that was naturally manna from heaven for the newsmen of the day. All sorts of reports were bandied about, and the public got to the point that anyone might have been missing might have been a victim. But some facts did come out. Janet Brown, the friend of Margaret's that had left, identified Margaret's clothing to the police. A local baker recognised the pants that had once belonged to poor daft Jamie, and they were being worn by Burke's nephew. This latter evidence meant that the four were charged with Jamie Wilson's murder on the 19th of November. However, evidence was still thin. So Sir William Ray, who was in charge of the investigation, offered Hare immunity from prosecution. This legally also meant that Hare's wife would be immune because Hare could not testify against his wife. This action by Sir William quickly saw him getting sufficient evidence as William Hare sang like the proverbial canary. Consequently, Burke and his wife were charged with the murders of Mary Patterson, James Wilson, and Margaret Doherty. Of course, as I said, this was all over the papers. And a new word was even made. Created from William Burke's surname, the term Birking meant to murder someone by suffocation or that you had committed what was known as an anatomy murder, that is, killing to sell to a surgeon. By this stage, given the social class of the two killers, Knox was being portrayed as an educated puppet master that had been controlling the two simple working class men. The trial of Burke and his wife began on a Christmas Eve. A huge crowd gathered outside and stayed throughout. Because of legal reasons, the trial had to run non-stop. It actually didn't finish until it was Christmas Day. Among the 55 witnesses called to the stand, Hare's evidence on the stand was condemning to both Burke and his wife. It took just 50 minutes for the jury to find Burke guilty of Mary Doherty's murder and sentenced to death. His wife's verdict was given as not proven, and she was released. This is a great term in Scottish law. It means that there isn't sufficient evidence for a conviction, but you are thought to have committed the crime. Basically, the jury are saying, we know you did it, we just can't prove it. Remember that criminals could be taken by medical facilities for dissection? Well, in his sentencing, the judge stated, quote, your body should be publicly dissected and anatomized, and I trust that if it is ever customary to preserve skeletons, yours will be preserved, in order that posterity may keep in remembrance your atrocious crimes. End quote. Oh, the irony. Burke was publicly hanged on January 28th of the following year, and on the 1st of February, his corpse was publicly dissected by Professor Munro at Edinburgh University. Near rioting occurred in the push and shove of students trying to get tickets to the event. His skeleton is still, to this day, on display in the Anatomical Museum at Edinburgh Medical School. Not much is known of Burke's wife and the Hare couple. All three were attacked by mobs as they sought to leave Edinburgh, resulting in police forces having to intervene and aid in their fleeing. Burke's wife vanished after leaving Edinburgh. Hare's wife was put on a vessel bound for Belfast and she too was never heard from again. Hare was escorted out of town towards the English border, whereupon he too was never known to history again. Some believe that while he was in London, he fell into a lime pit and was blinded, living out his life as a blind beggar. But this is just speculation. Robert Knox had his professional reputation permanently tarnished. However, he was still a practicing doctor in London when he died in 1862. These men were the most famous of the infamous grave-digging resurrection men. However, in 1831, only a couple of years after the sensationalised events in Edinburgh, another crime was splashed across the newspapers. A 14-year-old boy was killed and an attempt was made to sell his body to King's College in London. A gang known as the London Burkers, again adapting that name from Birking, were known for grave robbing and taking inspiration from the events in the north. They'd moved to murder to get corpses. Two men were subsequently caught and hanged. Certainly, the newspapers were making the most of any reports of grave robbing that they could. This, combined with general public knowledge, meant that such heinous crimes, as I've mentioned, forced the government into action. So it was that the Anatomy Act 1832 came into being that year on the 1st of August. This superseded the prior legal stipulation of the Murder Act 1752, which had only allowed for executed murders in the use of anatomical research. Under this new 1832 Act, bodies could now be donated to medical institutions for research. This was an attempt to create a larger legal supply of bodies in the hope that it would stop much of the criminal activity. And surprisingly, it worked. Donated bodies was just one aspect of the new supply for research. You could, of course, donate yourself once you were dead. Big shout out to any Monty Python fans out there. If you know, you know. But also, poor families would donate a body knowing that the institution they donated it to would later pay for the burial costs for the remains. This was an important factor for those in terrible poverty. The other aspect to the new act was that those that had died in hospital, prison, or a workhouse could also be forwarded to a medical school. Basically, the government flooded the existing market and made it no longer viable to steal bodies. The other medical advantage was that the bodies being examined and explored were often of a better condition than those that had been dug up. The Anatomy Act 1832 led directly to doctors learning far more about the human nervous system, for example. The medical podcasts I've done have always been popular. Let's face it, we all know that sex sells, but I think blood and gore come a close second. It's just a fascination that is part of the human condition and reminds us of how lucky we are that we're not the ones being written about. I want to recommend some essential reading if you like this topic. Lindsay Fitzharris's book, The Butchering Art, is an amazing work delving deep into the medical aspects of Victorian history. I'm guilty of having read it twice, so you should definitely check it out. And here endeth the episode. You can find me at victoriangaslamp.com. My contact details are on there as well. And you can follow me on Twitter at @VicGaslamp. And more importantly, on Instagram, where I post historical facts and trivia as well as photos related to the episodes. I am at @VictoriangaslAmp, all one word, there as well. Thanks for listening and keep a lookout for new episodes. And as always, I'll see you next time under the gas lamp.